Lecture 48, What Challenges Remain?
Well, hello once again, and welcome to the last of our lectures on the foundations of Western civilization, number 48. In this lecture, what we're going to do is perch ourselves in a way sort of in the early 17th century. We're going to look around, see what we notice, and we're going to look back, and we're going to look forward. We'll try, in a sense, to draw together some of the themes and issues that we've encountered throughout these lectures. We'll try to suggest one or two things about the directions that things might be expected to take in the centuries that would come after. You'll perhaps recall that on many occasions I've said, well, what if we played the time traveler game and we could stop the clock at certain points and visit there and ask ourselves, well, what do we think is going to happen next? Well, we'll kind of do that again, and in slightly larger terms, perhaps, in this very last lecture. Well, first of all, let's sketch in what we might call the geopolitical background. How did this world shape up politically in the late 16th to 17th centuries? Across the course of the 16th century, we can see the emergence of the kind of great power politics and diplomacy that would actually dominate the West until the collapse of the Soviet Empire in 1989. The collapse of the Soviet Empire, of course, left us with a unipolar world. I mean, in a certain sense, the entire political and diplomatic heritage, military heritage too, to a degree, was sort of left in the hands of the United States, which is obviously not yet a player in the 16th century. But this process, what we see around us in the world today, is the culmination of a rather coherent process that reaches back a long time. Now, if I call it a system, a great power system, let's be very clear. It was not a system in the sense that someone sat down and thought it up. But the diplomatic and political, the international system, if you like, from the 16th century until the late 20th, was one that consisted basically of a series of shifting patterns of alliances among the greatest European powers, with the smaller powers aligning themselves, or perhaps being forced to align themselves, with their more powerful neighbors. Now, in the context of Europe, the first fundamental aspect of this system was the Habsburg-Valois rivalry. That is, the struggle between the Valois rulers, the rulers of the Valois dynasty in France, and the Habsburg rulers of the Spanish Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. Now, how had this come about? Well, it had come about in a way that would be sort of impossible in the modern world, but was still very much a part of this early modern world that we have been talking about. It was a series of dynastic marriages effecting actually two great unions that then culminated in one stupendous dynastic arrangement. Okay, very quickly, here's what happened. Maximilian of Austria, the Holy Roman Emperor, married Mary of Burgundy. Now, Mary of Burgundy was the heiress to both Burgundy, a substantial chunk of eastern France, and the Netherlands. They had a son, Philip. Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married, as we have seen, and unified the Spanish crowns, the crowns of Castile and Aragon. They had a daughter, Johanna. Johanna and Philip married, creating a Habsburg sphere of influence that reached all over Europe and, owing to the Spanish conquests in the New World, extended to the Americas as well. Thus far, the Habsburg situation. Now, under Philip II of Spain, a huge imperial realm existed, but eventually, as he approached his own death, came in 1556, he divided his realms such that his brother Ferdinand took the Austrian lands, while Charles V took Spain, its overseas possessions, and to a degree, its interests in the Italian peninsula as well. These Habsburg lands, one has only to think about it for a moment, surrounded France. So a great deal of French policy was addressed to eluding domination by this sort of massive Habsburg monster that had them surrounded.